A pleasure always to welcome back Dr. Mark, who normally speaks every Monday night, and people are welcome every Monday night to join his class. We're ranked now great rabbinic thinkers. We're going through, we'll resume that January 6th, but now he's going to give a little talk on Hinduism. I don't know when their new year is, but since December 25th, we use as a catch-all for Judaism and other religions. We will have a little bit to hear on Judaism and Hinduism, probably something we know less about than most of us know about Judaism and Christianity. So, Vakasha, Dr. Mark.
And I have the good luck, I guess, that unlike last year when I had, I was in the middle of the day, if I go 5 minutes or 10 minutes, we have time for questions, it's okay, because anyone who wants to stay on, stay on. If you don't, you can just log off. But no one, I'm not taking time from anyone behind me right now coming up. So that's good. Now, I titled it Thoughts on Judaism and Hinduism. And actually, these thoughts, I published some of them. They're in response let me show you. Am I host here? Yes, I'm host. So let me get my screen here. It was originally in response to this book by Alon Goshen Gottstein. It's already been a year, if you can remember, that we did this program last year, and one of our speakers was Alon Goshen Gottstein, the son, incidentally, of the famous Moshe Goshen Gottstein. And his area of study is really about Judaism and other religions. He runs an institute called the Elijah Institute. In fact, you can see his books on top here. His most recent book is this one, Covenant and World Religions, Irving Greenberg, Jonathan Sacks, and the Quest for Orthodox Pluralism. If you recognize those names, it's Greenberg, Jonathan Sacks, you'll know what he's referring to. But he's become quite interested in Hinduism. And so what I'm going to be offering is, he's the first writer in the Orthodox world to deal with Hinduism. Now, look, it's a new religion, as Rabbi Kelman just mentioned, for most of us. Therefore, unlike Christianity, where, we have over 1,000 years of discussions, halachic positions and hashkafic views, as Rabbi Miller mentioned, it's very new with Hinduism. We're just beginning our examination of it. Second of all, it's really important for the reason that if you know what's going on in the world, India, which is now the largest country in the world, it's overtaken China. And fortunately, India is an ally with Israel. And you have many Indians, there's Israeli-Indian cooperation, security, and otherwise. And it's going to become more and more part of our consciousness. In fact, many Israelis go to India. I was in a place in India where it's like an Israeli settlement. It just is taken over by Israelis. They only speak Hebrew there. And therefore, it's something that we need to examine. And what can we say about Hinduism? And I thought about this idea of how we relate to Hinduism when I was in India. And I was walking through the streets of a city, today they call it Varanasi, or Varanasi, I think they pronounce it, but it's the old Benares. Benares is one of the important cities, the most really important city, classical city in Hinduism in India. Benares, that's where you might have seen where they burn the bodies on the Ganges. And so you walk through, if anyone who goes to India, you really have to go there, but there are temples and little shrines on every street. And seeing that, that really focused my mind, I think, on the important issues which we're going to deal with now and which Goshen Gottstein discusses. But let me first call your attention, I think, to a significant point that Goshen makes right at the very beginning, a crucial point in my opinion. His first chapter of the book, by the way, is called The Shadal Crisis. Now, some of us will remember about 15 years ago the issue of the shadals. The idea that this wasn't a new issue. This had already been dealt with in the 70s, but the early 2000s, again, it was raised that maybe these come from India, and maybe there's a question of Avodah Zarah, foreign worship, because when they take the hair off their head, that it's an offering to an idol. We'll get into that in a little bit. I just want to call your attention, by the way, if anyone's interested in this, I can send you the link here. You can see it. There's a whole page that was done by someone while this controversy is going on with all the discussions put together of all the different rabbis who wrote on this matter. And I also have to say, I hate to say it, but one of the most interesting things put together is, here you have a page, he has any discussions of it, Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro, with all sorts of links and showing how Rav Yoshev originally permitted the shadels, and then he said no, but he said that he only said no because he was fed certain facts, and if these facts are incorrect, then not to pay attention. I only mention this because anyone who wants to look at it, this Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro, who happens to be a Talmud Chacham, I'm not in the, he happens to be, though, one of the most dangerous people Jews are alive today. Neturei Karta, everyone knows they're a bunch of clowns, and you listen to them speak with their heavy accents. Yaakov Shapiro, just Google his name. He is now the leading anti-Zionist spokesman in America. Forget Peter Beinart, forget the rest. He's speaking, his videos within 2 days have hundreds of thousands of listeners. And here's a rabbi with a long beard and speaking against, not in a theological sense, against the state of Israel as we know it, against Jerusalem as being, you know, he is advocating in the Neturei Karta anti-Israel while we're at war. I don't know. I do not know anyone today more dangerous in terms of, for the outside world, legitimizing not just the anti-Zionism in a, you know, in a moderate sense, but the idea that Israel has no right to exist. And anyone could say I'm not an anti-Semite, because if I hate the state of Israel and not just oppose things about it, but want it to be destroyed, there's Yaakov Shapiro. So leave it at that. But he happened to be quite involved. He was the one who was dealing with the Moshe Sternbach and others on this issue. So let's leave that and return to our major topic. Now, Goshen, when he discusses the Shadel issue, he notes that the rabbis who wrote Tshuvot on this matter were writing these things without any knowledge, really, of Hinduism. They were just deciding, they're either assuming that this is a form of offering to an idol and then dealing with that halachically, or they were saying, well, on the assumption that it's an offering to an idol. But it's very strange, he thinks, and I agree with him, that here you have Poskim looking at a matter without, almost uniformly, without trying to understand the very religion that they're dealing with. And we find the same thing with Christianity, I have to say. Many people who deal with Christianity, Poskim, halachic authorities, really have no knowledge, no understanding of Christianity. And we would never tolerate this in an area of someone, at least I hope we wouldn't, discussing, let's say, electricity or kashrus, with really not knowing the basic facts. So I just find that interesting. Now, in fact, I'll go further. And this relates to something that we heard Rabbi Miller say. I find it strange that all of these judgments were offered about Hinduism based only on what people picked up in the air, or in a couple cases, based on book knowledge, without having any knowledge of Hinduism as a living religion. I happen to think that there's something troubling with discussing, just in a sort of objective sense, whether Hinduism is Avodah Zarah, without wanting to learn from Hindus what the religion means to them, and how it has an effect on their life. Because I think, and in my new book, dealing with Rav Kook, you'll see what he says. He goes even further than Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, that this has to be part, I think, of a discussion. That when we deal with other religions, it's not just a matter of what do the books say. I think we have to look, as the Meiri puts it, you know, and he speaks about nations that are bound by the bonds of religion. Gedurim b'darchei adam. So he's talking about religion, non-Jewish religions could have a positive impact. And we don't see this, unfortunately, with Hinduism, with the discussions on the Shadel dispute. Another important issue, and Goshen mentions this, a serious problem is who speaks for Hinduism? I mean, Hinduism is a huge religion with, just like Christianity is very broad, Hinduism is very broad. In fact, some people even deny that Hinduism can be called a religion. It's more of like an ethos. And everything you say about Hinduism, yes, we all know Hindus are vegetarian. Yes, except for those who aren't vegetarian. I mean, you can, it's very hard to give broad judgments, but that bring into all aspects of Hinduism. But you can make general, I guess, assumptions. So how do you judge, though, the religion? Goshen asks. Do you judge it by the intellectual elites, the priests, the professors, the scholars, or do you judge it based on the masses, how they understand it? Now, this is an old problem, and I think it applies to all religions. All religions have the popular religion. We have it in Judaism, obviously, popular religion, and then you have the religion of the thinkers. So when you deal with a religion like Hinduism, what type of judgment do you make? And I confess I thought a lot about this while walking around Benares. On the one hand, if you look at any textbook on Hinduism, if you look at any world religion book, if you speak to Hindus in the West, you will be told uniformly that Hinduism is a monotheistic religion. Belief in one God, all the different gods, small g, Vishnu, Shiva, whatever, they're all manifestations of Brahman, of the one God. And that's the standard understanding. In fact, we'll see what the chief rabbinate of Israel says about this in a few minutes. In fact, I'll just say, I mean, these terms gods, which we refer to as gods, Daniel Sperber, who also has a book, at least years ago, he told me he was complete, on Judaism and Hinduism. He lived in India as a young man. And he has a book on Judaism and Hinduism. We'll get back to him a little later. He points out that this term God, you know, when the English went to India and they wanted to make sense of what they're seeing here, they called these different things gods. However, so Sperber says, what would have happened if instead of calling them gods, they referred to them Shiva, Vishnu, etc., monkey god, all them, that they're angels? So that when we looked at Hinduism, we'd speak in terms of Brahman, you know, the ultimate, and then we'd see all these angels. The fact that would we then consider it avodah zarah, or is it only because we use the term, the English term, gods? And what does it mean, gods? So we'll come back to that in a little bit. So that's an important point by Sperber. Okay, so I'm in India, and I traveled all over. The only place I didn't go, because I didn't have enough time, really, the important place was Amritsar, where the Sikhs are. I have to go back another time. In fact, when you're in Amritsar, you're right near the Pakistani border, and you can actually cross over and cross back just 1 minute and get your Pakistan stamp. And I was all ready to do that. So my wife said that, what is Israel going to do next time I go to Israel? And then in the end, I didn't have time, so I didn't go. But I hired guides wherever I went. And these are college-educated ones. And I asked them all the same question. When you speak in terms of the different gods, do you understand them to be manifestations of the one God, or are these separate gods? And uniformly, every one of these people I was with said to me, separate gods, totally separate gods, not manifestations of a one God. In complete contradiction to what, as I said, you'll see in every textbook written from the West on Hinduism. When adherents of Hinduism hold such vastly different understandings, how do you evaluate such a religion? I've actually only found one discussion in halakhic literature that discusses this matter, and that's with reference to the Shadal controversy. And it's with a very fascinating posek of all sorts of interesting ideas. His name was Ramanasha Klein. I've spoken about him many times in the past. He used to sign his name in Menashe HaKatan, because Klein, of course, means Katan. And he was one of the rabbis who was lenient when it came to the Shadals. And he records in his responsum on this, that I think he has two responsum, but that he spoke to a rabbi, is a rabbi, Rav Aaron David Dunner. Rav Aaron David Dunner, was from the Dunner family of England, was the rabbi that Rabbi Elyashiv, when word got to Rabbi Elyashiv that his ruling, that the Shadals, there wasn't a problem, that maybe this was incorrect, he sent Rabbi Dunner, because Rabbi Dunner knows English, to India. And Rabbi Dunner went to the temple and he interviewed people, and he came back with a report that what they're doing when they're cutting the hair is a form of offering to the gods. And therefore, this led to Rav Yashiv's psak that it's forbidden. Now, Rabbi Menashe Klein records that he spoke to Rav Aaron Dunner about this matter, and he said that Rav Menashe Klein actually investigated this, not speaking to people in person, but speaking, but literature he read, because he reads English. And he told Rabbi Dunner, he writes, that the Hindu priests and the scholars who write on Hinduism all deny that cutting the hair has any connection to idolatrous offerings. In fact, if you go to Yaakov Shapiro, the site I just showed you, he has a letter there from Professor Diana Eck from Harvard, like the leading scholar, I guess, of Hinduism in America. And he has a whole interview there with a Hindu priest. There's no question that the cutting off of the hair has nothing to do with an offering to an idol. It's a way of purifying yourself, giving up, getting rid of something that you value, your hair, so that when you go into the temple, then you've raised yourself to a different level. But the cutting the hair itself has no connection whatsoever, an offering to an idol or anything like that. So Rabbi Kleins repeats that to Rabbi Dunner, that, you know, you gave this whole report to Rabbi Elisha, but all you have to do is speak to the experts in Hinduism, and they deny it. And Rabbi Dunner's reply was that he knows what the priests say and the scholars say. So why then did he conclude that the haircutting was part of idolatrous ceremony? He claims that the scholars and the priests are embarrassed by what the masses think. That is, the masses, I'm taking him at his word, that he spoke to the masses, and they see the cutting the hair as an actual offering to the idol, and the scholars are embarrassed by this. I don't know why he has to say they're embarrassed by this, just simply say that they have a different opinion, but whatever. Rabbi Dunner's view is that the masses think it's a form of idolatry. Doesn't matter what the scholars think. And Rabbi Klein responds with a different approach, quite fascinating. He says that when seeking to discover the meaning of a practice in another religion, it's the priests, it's the intellectuals, it's the experts who should be asked and relied upon. Since if you read the writings of the experts in Hinduism, they tell you that this haircutting has no connection to idolatry, then that's what the halacha is. And the masses follow the religious leaders. And if the masses have an incorrect opinion on something, that doesn't change the halacha. He even cites Talmudic sources, which he says support his notion that it's the religious leaders who are determinative when it comes to evaluating a religion. Now, this is a matter I'll leave for the halacha authorities. Yet I must say that Rabbi Klein's position also doesn't sit completely well with me. I mean, I can see why many would regard the priest's evaluation as the end of the matter, since, I mean, they are the leaders of the religion. And as far as they're concerned, there's no element of Avodah Zarah. But if the masses think that the hair cutting has an idolatrous component, I don't know if this is what they actually think. From what I've seen, everything I've seen is that the masses don't think this either, and that Rabbi Dunner was completely misled from A to Z. Without any background going there, speaking to them, it seems to me, from what I've seen, he was completely misled. But let's assume, though, that they do have do believe that it has an idolatrous component. I think you could ask in opposition or by a client, what does it matter what the priests say? If the masses believe that this is their religion, meaning how they understand the ritual, and it's connected to Avodah Zarah, wouldn't that have significance, unlike Rabbi Klein? So let me give you an example. John Doe belongs to Religion X. Religion X does not sanction idolatry. Yet if John Doe performs an idolatrous action, or an action with idolatrous intent, are we to say that that's not idolatry because the religion doesn't officially sanction this? I think this only goes to show how difficult it is for one to speak of, quote, authentic expressions of a religion to reach conclusions. Take Judaism, for example. Let's say we have a group of people in a shul who start bowing before the Aron HaKodesh, the Holy Ark, and they think that God dwells in it and God's essence is distributed among the Torah scrolls. Let's say. Now, there's no question that this would be Avodah Zarah. It does not matter if I get up and say, well, you know, Judaism doesn't teach this. In that shul, if that's what everyone does, that's an action of Avodah Zarah. The fact that these people are a bunch of idiots and they think that God is representing the Torah, I don't think that changes matters. And at the end, by the way, any questions or comments, you probably type them in, I'll get to at the end. I don't think that changes matters, that would be Avodah Zarah. In yeshivas, we call this the metzios. See, I don't know what the metzios is, what the reality is. We'll come back to that perhaps later. The advantage of what Goshen tries to do, and I'll have some criticisms in a minute, but is that he has spent a lot of time in India. He has studied Hinduism. It's not book knowledge. He studied under Hindu thinkers and observed Hindu rituals. And his goal there is to bring Jews to an appreciation of Hinduism, to show that in many ways it's similar to Judaism, and that it should not be regarded as Avodah Zarah. And as Rabbi Miller pointed out, we shouldn't, although within in India, they do worship idols. So, and they do use idols and they do worship idols. So it is actually idolatry. But, for example, Christianity is definitely, as far as Jews are concerned, Avodah Zarah, but it's not idolatry. It's foreign worship. But in any event, Goshen's point is that Hinduism is not Avodah Zarah, despite what looks like Avodah Zarah. If you walk around, let's say, Benares again, and you see the shrines and the temples and all these corners, it sure looks like what we imagine Avodah Zarah should be, to be. But Goshen's book has this activist agenda. And it's not just Hindus he's concerned with. He wants to look at the entire idea of Avodah Zarah in line with his understanding. Again, this is from the liberal side of Orthodoxy, that there needs to be a contemporary Jewish theology of religions. And he's not the only one doing it. I just received a book in the mail delivered here in Florida yesterday, which I've already read 50 pages of it. And it's this book, edited by Yaakov Nagin. I think it's Nagin, Nagin, I don't know. He spoke for us, as Torah in Motion. He spoke for Rabbi Kelman's program last year. God Shall Be One, Re-envisioning Judaism's Approach to Other Religions. Introduction or preface by Rabbi Kenneth Brander, published by Lindenbaum, or Rabbi Brander is now the head of it. And it's the largest grouping of articles focusing on Judaism and other religions, biblical period, Talmudic period, medieval period. It's quite a fascinating book. In fact, had I known about this 2 months ago, I just learned of this book last week. I might have recommended one that some of these people could also speak. It's Asaf Malach has interesting articles, or by Saul Rosenblatt. So you see already that with the world becoming much smaller, there's a great deal of interest. And Rabbi Nagin and Rabbi Brander, they're explicit that now we're in a different world and we have to look at our tradition and see whether we can understand things perhaps differently than had been in the past. Again, all in line with the tradition, but being in that we're now in a different sort of environment today. Now, crucial for Goshen's argument is that Hindus worship the same God as Jews. Already, this is going to be an interesting and perhaps controversial argument because it's not even clear whether Christians worship the same God as Jews. There was this statement that came out signed by many people, including leading Jewish thinkers, David Novak, for instance, and others, called Dabru Emet, in which it said that we can't judge Christians the way we used to when they would just be killing us all the time. So we just we couldn't respond physically, so we responded with the pen. In a different era, when Christians are treating us with respect, again, not all Christians, but there's a whole host. I mean, there's so many Christians in this country, certainly in America and many others who are strong supporters of the state of Israel. And we don't even want to imagine what would it be like if in America, if you didn't have the evangelicals and others when it comes to support for Israel. So the idea is that, we have to now that we don't, not in a polemical era, how are we supposed to look at Christianity? So Dabru Emet's point was to offer a more positive view. It's interesting. Rav Kook says, I mentioned this in my new book, which is already, it's published. It exists. I haven't seen it, but it's in London and it's being shipped to America, but you can order it on Amazon. Rav Kook says that since Jesus is worshiped as a God, we can't say anything positive about it. But if they don't, when they stop worshiping him as a God, then we can then look and say, well, maybe he has some good ideas. And he says, like, if you have a piece of gold that's an idol, it's, all you can relate to it is a negative way. You can't have anything positive to say about it. You're supposed to be disgusted by it. But if you melt down that gold and then make something else out of it, then you can appreciate the gold. But it's not clear whether Christians worship the same God. Dabru Emet thinks they do, but there are others. John Levinson, for instance, of Harvard, I think probably David Berger as well, and others. In fact, I do think David Berger, because he wrote a response to Dabru Emet, I think it was in commentary, would say no, that they don't worship the same God. So it's not, they can worship a God, but it's not really what we call the same God. So it's not clear, even with regard to Christianity. But as for Hinduism, to say that Hindus worship the same God, it's quite interesting position. But if that is correct, then all the rituals that we look at, and we'll talk a little bit about perhaps, are to be seen in a different light than rituals of Avodah Zarah. That is, if you see a ritual, a Hindu doing a ritual, and you think it's to some other god, well, then immediately your attitude is, this is Avodah Zarah. However, if you assume that they're worshiping the same god, then the rituals they're doing are not to a foreign god, but they're to the god of the, they're to the one god. And if that's the case, then the ritual is not an Avodah Zarah. In fact, I'm not sure about this point, but as far as I can tell, if you believe in one God as a non-Jew and you choose to represent that God as an idol, I haven't been able to find, correct me if I'm wrong, that for the people hold of Shituf, but even not, that would be forbidden. Jews can't that. Do that. But is a non-Jew forbidden from having an image of the one God who they worship? I haven't been able to find it. Correct me if someone else can find it. Now, the elephant in the room, of course, is, I said, the multiple Hindu deities. And is not the worship of idols clearly Avodah Zarah? And make no mistake about it, Hindus worship idols. I'm not talking here about, let's say, in the Catholic Church, where you'll have a statue of the Virgin Mary or something. That's just there to focus their mind and to remind themselves of Jesus or of Mary, statues of Jesus. They don't think that there's actually any divinity in the statue. No Christians believe that. However, in Hinduism, the statue, it's, if you want to understand, I think the best way is we will look at Avodah Zarah in biblical times. What did the masses think? You know, the Torah is speaking about all these idolaters, and we know the Jewish people or the people of Israel, they constantly fell back into idolatry. So I know it's mocked in Tanakh, and we have the story of Avraham. You know, he makes the idols in his father's shop, and then he destroys. You know, the father's shop, and Avraham destroys the idols. And the upshot of the story is, you know, how could you worship something you made? What these texts are doing is placing in a simplistic, naive way the theology of the ancients. Now, the ancients were not sophisticated scientifically like us, but they weren't stupid people. No one believes that if I take a stone and I make it, now that's God and I can worship this God. I mean, that's not the theology, and that's not the theology of Hinduism today. The notion is that you make this stone and then the God assumes residence in it. The God is not encompassed in the stone. God is all over, but the God for us, to assist us, will assume residence. So it's a real presence. And Hindus believe this also. When they first make it, when you open up, you know, the eyes, you take the eyes so the eyes can see, the idea is that it's very powerful. So you don't want the eyes to see you. So they do believe that there is a real presence. And I know this might sound, that this is like way over the board, and this is the doctrine of Avodah Zarah. But remember, the ancients believed in lots of different gods. If you believe in one God and you believe that it can assume a residence or an aspect of it, that could be Shituf. We'll get back to Shituf in a minute. But without me now describing my own ideas about this, which I thought a lot, I have to say that the chief rabbinate of the state of Israel has actually weighed into this issue. And I think you'll be very surprised by what I'm going to show you now. Now, why would the chief rabbinate of the state of Israel get involved? Well, first of all, we have these relations going on between Israel and India. And after the Shadow controversy, where Indian television showed videos of people burning their shadows because they were from Indian hair, this created a lot of ill will. And you certainly don't want to have ill will with the Indians. I was surprised, by the way, in Goshen's book that he doesn't mention the fact that Chief Rabbinate has made his approach much easier. There was in 2007, there was a groundbreaking interfaith gathering between representatives of the Chief Rabbinate and of Hindu religious leaders. And I want to show you something here, because I think you will need to be sitting down to when you hear some of this. You'd be shocked, I believe. Two gatherings. Here is the first gathering that took place in India. And you see that that's Rabbi Metzger, the former chief rabbi. And you see the picture. There's Daniel Sperber, incidentally. And you go on. There's all pictures. I mean, there's various documents. But what I want to read to you now is, here's the chief rabbinate statement that was made in 2007, that the chief rabbinate agreed to this. In fact, you have that it doesn't here, but you can see the original one, the signing. Here it says as follows. I want to read it to you. Okay, hold on a second. I don't want to just read it to you out. I want you to see the text. Ah, here it is. The participants affirm that. Now, this is what the chief rabbinate of Israel affirmed. Their respective traditions teach faith in one supreme being who is the ultimate reality, who has created this world in its blessed diversity, and who has communicated divine ways of action for humanity for different people in different times and places. Wow. The chief rabbinate of Israel accepts Hinduism as believing in one supreme being, and also that this supreme being has communicated divine ways of action for humanity for different peoples in different times and places. What does that mean? Does that mean that there are Hindu prophets that are from God? Wait till you see what Rav Kook says in my new book, the stuff I speak about. But it doesn't have to mean that. It can simply mean that God, through God's providence, finds a way that people around the world know the proper way to live. But it's still quite striking. Now, listen, here's in 2000, in 2017, sorry, 2008, they had another gathering in Israel. This was hosted in Israel. And here you see, there you see Chief Rabbi Amar. That is that's Rabbi Ratzon Arusi, also on the Chief Rabbinic Council. That's Rabbi Cardozo, I believe. I don't know if that's Rabbi Abergel or not. There's Rabbi Sperber again. And you can read through this, and there's pictures and discussions. I mean, meeting with President Shimon Peres, that's Rabbi Shar Yashuv Cohen. So a whole discussion. By the way, Rabbi Sperber, he has a whole see the other rabbi. He has a whole statement here, and he says as follows. I think some of you will find this of interest. He mentions what I said before, that we use the word God. Gods, as opposed to devas, you know, the Hindu term, that perhaps created some problems. I just think it's interesting, though, underneath. I don't know what the chief rabbi thought when he says as follows. Sperber says, we mentioned briefly the great theologians in monotheism, Moses Maimon, who actually in his early years formulated a dogma, 13 principles of faith. It is interesting to know that in later works, he never referred to them, and I am not even sure if he thought that each one of these 13 were actually something that each Jewish person has to believe in. So here we see Professor Dan, Rabbi Sperber, stating that he doesn't know if the Rambam really believed that in all the 13 principles is an obligation for everyone. So that's just as a side point. Those who know some of my writings will see why I found that interesting. But they came out with a statement after this 2008 meeting. And look what it says in number one and two. It repeats again that we both, Jews and Christians and Hindus, believe in one supreme being, the creator and guider of the cosmos. And look at number two. It is recognized that the one supreme being, both in its formless and manifest aspects, has been worshipped by Hindus over the millennia. This does not mean that Hindus worship gods and idols. The Hindu relates to only the one supreme being when he or she prays to a particular manifestation. So here we see the chief rabbinate of the state of Israel affirming that although Hindus believe in different manifestations of the gods, and you can worship, and you have, let's say, a statue that you pray to you are praying to the manifestation of the one God in the statue. And that's not regarded as, according to the statement, as problematic. And they don't worship gods. So what do they worship then? Again, this gets back to the point that Sperber made, that gods is just the term that the English used. If instead of gods, we used the term angels, no one would have any problem, and it wouldn't be regarded as a avodah zarah. It would simply be that they're turning to angels with requests. Jews do that. Jews turn to angels sometimes with requests. Or in the slichos, we have one of the famous slichos, machnisei rachamim. So you see how complicated this matter is. And let me also mention one more. Okay, actually, in the interest of time, let me move on. I said that Goshen doesn't mention anything in his book. Same God, other God. However, he also wrote another book right around the same time. And here's his other book. And this is going to complicate matters. The Jewish Encounter with Hinduism, History, Spirituality, Identity. So here he has another book dealing with how Jews have viewed Hinduism, published in 2016, just around the same time as the other book. And here he does take up the chief rabbinate statement. And he says as follows. Now, you all heard the two statements that I read to you. This is what Goshen says about these statements, or the first statement, the 2007, but 2008 is the same thing. The theological, let alone halachic implications of this opening clause, namely the clause that states that that both Jews and Hindus teach faith in one supreme being who has created the world, etc., and has communicated divine ways of action to humanity in different times and places. Goshen says that this should be taken with a grain of salt. In other words, Goshen himself believes this, but he's saying that the chief rabbis, who we know the chief rabbis are quite conservative in the state of Israel with a small c, we're not dealing with liberals here. Rather, we're dealing with people who are strict on halacha, and this isn't like a liberal chief rabbinate. So Goshen says, in his opinion, that you should take it with a grain of salt. In other words, the Jewish signatories, other than Sperber, never intended their words to be taken literally. And this declaration is like other apologetic statements when people on the inside know they're for outward consumption. Or perhaps Goshen means that the rabbis who signed the declaration weren't really aware of its theological significance. However you evaluate the matter, since Goshen feels that the people who signed it don't draw from it any practical halachic ramifications, it's of no use to him, and he moves in different directions. But as an aside, I just have to say, on the assumption that Goshen is correct, that we're in a pretty pathetic place if it's true that a formal declaration signed by rabbis after an official interfaith gathering cannot be relied on to express the views of the signatories. How is that even possible? That when rabbis sign a document expressing their views, that we're going to say it's only done for apologetic purposes. So I'm going to leave that on the side. Now, what is Goshen's approach in trying to find a solution? He calls attention, he has a couple of approaches. In our trying to bring Hinduism into this great tent, where we can regard them as worship of the same God, not a avodah zarah, with all the halachic implications. He uses Meiri as well, as we heard from Rabbi Miller. The famous from Menachem Meiri, his, I guess we can call it religious tolerance, has assumed enormous significance in the modern Orthodox world. And for many, the Meiri's position, and I think that was what Rabbi Miller was channeling, Meiri's position intuitively seems to people, many people, not all, but I think people in the modern Orthodox world, and the Meiri's position is affirmed by people who've written on it, Rav Kook, or Aaron Salvechik, or Bill Zioffman, you go down the list. I think they see it as intuitively not only correct, but also the only moral option. I know this is problematic for many, because what does that mean, moral? I mean, so you're bringing in a new category. I mean, when you deal with halacha, usually you think in just in terms of what the sources say and how this phenomenon is to be evaluated. So to bring in this idea of a moral consideration, I think many halachic authorities wouldn't even recognize the validity of such a consideration. However, we have many who do believe in us. Shlomo Goren, incidentally, I was just speaking about him not long ago, so it's on my mind. He has a tshuva which he deals with the issue of a deaf mute in Jewish law, and he chooses to rely on a Jerusalem Talmud, a Yerushalmi, which is not usually done, but he says that this is, it's our halachic and our moral obligation. He uses the word musari. Again, some people won't even recognize that's a category, but for many, this is also important, and the Meiri's position, as it allows us, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg says that today the Meiri's position is the position we need to deal with, we need to adopt, because it allows us to live in a way that our inner morality really is not does not diverge from what we're told that Jewish law says. So that's the first approach. The Meiri's approach, for those who don't know, is that the definition of idolatry is if people are not bound by bonds of civilized behavior. That is, if they're evil, if they are if they're murderers, if they don't treat people properly, if they don't return lost objects. I mean, if they're not living a moral life, that's what the Talmud refers to as idolatry. Now, in fact, the Meiri specifically says, he speaks of those who worship the divinity in whatever form. And certainly Hinduism would fall into that category. Now, it's not entirely clear how Meiri understands the Talmudic passages dealing with idolatry. For a long time, I assumed as follows, and I even said this on a number of occasions, and it makes perfect sense. Without forgetting the Meiri, it has a certain sense to it that the Meiri distinguished between idolatry and idolaters. That is, an idolater is an immoral person. Someone who worships many gods and everything, but who's a good person, his theology is idolatry. But he is not an idolater that the sages spoken about. That is, the sages told us that there are certain people that we have to keep far away from. This person, his theology is idolatrous. It's obviously forbidden, but he is not in the category of an Oved Avodah Zarah of the sort that the rabbis spoke about. And for a long time, I thought that that was what the Meiri's, his opinion was, and it made sense to me. But the problem is, as I looked more into this, is that it's not what the Meiri seems to be saying. He seems to be saying that the people of his day who lived, and again, he's in medieval Provence. You're all invited to join our summer trip. We're going to Provence this summer, and we're not actually going to Perpignan where the Meiri's from, but we'll talk a lot about him because he's an important figure. We do our Torah Motion summer trips. Go to the website, please, and join us in Provence. He's writing in medieval Provence about how the people he lives among are good people. So this idea we have that medieval times was just one massacre and expulsion after another, and that Jews, it was only persecution, what Salah Baron termed the lachrymose version of Jewish history. That is, it's only tears, and you know, that's not the case. There are plenty of times where Jews lived good lives in security in parts of Europe. If you look at the Meiri, he seems to be saying that the people in his day who worship, let's say, Christianity, and who recognize the divinity, are by definition not engaged by the idolatry. That is, it's not that their religion is idolatry, but they themselves are not the idolater, like I originally thought. I don't think there's any doubt now that when I look at it, that he's saying they themselves are not idolatry. That is, that idolatry itself, if it's not connected to religion itself, if it's not connected to immoral behavior, is itself not regarded as idolatry. Now, this is a very problematic position, because I don't know how to make sense of a numerous Talmudic passage. Furthermore, this creates another problem, because what about martyrdom? If Christianity is not a religion of Avodah Zarah, even if the people are not to be regarded as idolaters in that classic sense, but if the religion is not a religion of Avodah Zarah because it encourages moral behavior, then given the choice of martyrdom or conversion to Christianity or Hinduism, martyrdom would not be halachically required, because these would not be religions. Christianity is not a religion of Avodah Zarah. Yet based on everything I know, it's impossible to imagine that a medieval Talmudist and halachist like Meiri thought that the Jewish law does not require martyrdom when faced the choice of conversion to Christianity or Hinduism, for that matter, or death. So I'm not really sure what to do with the Meiri. I'm definitely not going to bring in the idea of Shituf that Rabbi Miller mentioned, because there's no evidence of such a concept in Meiri. In fact, he alluded to this, so I'll say it more explicitly. I assume that it's anachronistic to speak of Shituf with the medieval period. And this I'm following Yaakov Katz, Louis Jacobs, David Berger. It's true that Rav Moshe Isserles, the Ashkenazic Shulchan Aruch, says that non-Jews are not obligated in Shituf. That is, that they can believe in one God with partnerships, with they can believe in the Father, and also they have the Son. Let's say that that's a kosher religion for them. And that then becomes accepted halacha in the Ashkenazic world. However, it does seem to be a reading a Tosfos more that's actually in this Tosfos. I know there's a big debate among the poskim. Does Tosfos really say this, or is Tosfos simply saying that when you cause a non-Jew to take an oath, it doesn't matter if he takes an oath in God and also, let's say, in a saint or something like that, but it doesn't mean it's okay for him to believe God divided into different parts or anything like that. You find that position stated by many, but you also find, and this became the mainstream view in the Ashkenazic world, that B'nai Noach are not obligated in Shituf. That's the language Tosfos uses, meaning that that while Jews are obligated to have a pure belief in God, non-Jews can have, as long as they believe in one God, it doesn't have to be pure. It can have different aspects to this God, etc. I asked David Berger a question once, because he's a leading advocate of the notion that the Ramah and others are mistaken in what Tosfos is saying. So I said to him, this was at a public a lecture. I said, well, being that the Ramah and so many other poskim understand Tosfos as saying that non-Jews are not obligated in Shituf. So Christianity, therefore, and Hinduism, as I'll argue in a minute, are an acceptable, permissible religion for non-Jews. You, Dr. Berger, you think that this is a mistake in Tosfos. However, that's your academic position. Is it okay, you think, for traditional Orthodox Jews, halachic Jews, to say that we will follow the Ramah's position, even though academically we think it's wrong, but because the Ramah himself said it, and the Ramah is enough of authority that even if it's not in Tosfos, he himself has authority. And Professor Berger thought that that's okay, that it would be okay. He thought, he doesn't think that this is inconsistent, that even though he believes that the Ramah's interpretation of Tosfos is incorrect, the Ramah is the Ramah. And once he establishes it, and once other poskim establish it, an academic understanding doesn't trump the halacha as it's recorded there. Goshen goes on, he discusses the Rambam, and let me just make a quick comment about the Rambam in the interest of time. Not to go into any detail, because obviously the Rambam is going to be a problem when you deal with Christianity, when you deal with Hinduism, because the Rambam is absolutely clear that Christianity is Avodah Zarah. It's absolute Avodah Zarah. And any division of God into different parts for the Rambam is completely no good. And that would apply to Christianity as well. I mean, the Trinity, any divisions, that's impermissible for the Rambam. And the Rambam knew very well what Christianity was about. He's spoken about this when he came to, when he comes to Eretz Yisrael, when he comes to Akko, comes in, I mean, it's a crusader kingdom there. And he knew very well. In fact, he refers to the Trinity. Rav Sabugon even discusses the Trinity. In my initial thoughts on dealing with the Rambam, I focused on the position of the Raivan. The Rambam famously in his Laws of Tshuva, chapter 3, Halacha 7, says that if you believe that God has a physical form, you're a heretic. And the Raivad on the spot says no. Yes, the Raivad assumes that God has no physical form, but if you mistakenly think that God has a physical form, then you're not a heretic. You're just a mistaken Jew because you were misled. You read the Torah. The Torah speaks about God's outstretched arm. You saw certain agadic passages. So it's a big dispute between the Rambam and the Raivad. It's often been formulated as kafira b'shogeg, that is unwitting heresy. If I'm a heretic because I don't know any better, am I still a heretic or not? And the Raivad says no. So I thought that perhaps based on this Rivad, also Rivad, incidentally, also from Provence, although the city, Poitiers, that he's from, it has a new name today, but we'll pass right by it on our bus. I thought that perhaps, therefore, if someone, let's say a non-Jew, affirmed that that a person, let's say Jesus, is God, and then worship this person as a god, that this should not be regarded as idolatry, according to the Rivad. Because the Rivad says that it's not heresy to assume that God has a physical form. So if it's not heresy to assume that God has a physical form, then I might think that this person over here is God and I worship him. And I found that there was one rabbi in, I think it's the 17th century, who actually said that. But I was convinced that, because remember, Christians, they're not worshiping other gods. They're worshiping God, even if they're mistaken in assuming that he incarnated himself. And this approach would also have great relevance to Hinduism. I mean, the whole notion of an avatar. Avatar, you know it as a movie. But it's the word avatar is when a god incarnates him or herself into a physical form. And there's been all the sorts of avatars. Now, the problem with my understanding is that the Riva did regard Christianity as avodah zarah. There's no question about that. And as he thought that the worship of Jesus is worship of a man, what we might call a foreign god. So then how to solve this problem? If the Rivad says you can assume that God is a physical form and people are worshiping Jesus, they say it's God. And you say it's not God. So now it's going to be a dispute. Is this God? Is it not God? I mean, that's not what you see if you look in the Rivad. Again, I want to thank Dr. Berger for enlightening me on this and that, and I'm not the only one who erred in this matter. There's others as well, in addition to the rabbi I mentioned. As Dr. Berger explained, and he's absolutely correct, the reason that Rivad does not regard you as a heretic, if you think God is a physical form, is not the same as identifying an actual real object with God. I mean, if you're going to assume that I can identify an object or a person as God, then I can say that the sun is God and worship the sun. I can say that this person is God and worship God. The tree worshiper thinks that the tree is God. All this is clearly avodah zarah. What the Rivad is tolerant of is one who worships the one God, the unseen God, but imagines that he has a characteristic, a physical characteristic that he doesn't have. The tree worshiper worships the tree and mistakenly believes that the tree is God. So there's a big difference between worshiping the deity and thinking that the deity has a physical form versus actually identifying a physical object as God. That has to be a avodah zarah, absolutely. Now, okay, so getting to the conclusion. What Goshen wants to do, he thinks the most fruitful approach to show that Hinduism is not a avodah zarah is asking, do we worship the same God? And he wonders, how can you establish this? And he points to things like the idea of creation, of purity, of holiness, of miracles, that supports, he says, a religious commonality that can justify the affirmation of a common God. He says, if a religion can bring you to a real experience of God, one that's recognized by its fruits, the God at the center must be recognized as God, the same God known as our tradition. In other words, if you look at Hindus, and you see that their lives are religious lives and that they're inspired to live a certain way by their belief and it's the one God, then it's, and they believe in a one God, then it's the same God as ours. Now, I don't know. I'm a little skeptical of this because first of all, I don't know how important the notion of the same God is. What does that mean, the same God? From a halachic standpoint, in order for non-Jews to remove themselves from avodah zarah, I think it's enough for them to believe in one God, even if this God is very different than the Jewish God. I mean, since when do non-Jews need to believe, according to most, in the Jewish God? If they believe in one God, however they believe in that God, all of a sudden, then it's not, they're not worshiping multiple gods. Now, I say this a bit tongue-in-cheek when I say the Jewish God, because I don't even know how one would begin to define the Jewish God. The God of the Rambam is very different than the God of Rav Yitzchak Gorya, for instance. So I don't even think we can speak of it, quote, the Jewish God. What I believe, and now I'm speaking myself, the most fruitful avenue for a Jewish approach to Hinduism, which, and we're just beginning this in the last two decades, is by using the concept of shituf that I mentioned already. and treating Hinduism as it's understood by the intellectuals, namely that all the gods are manifestations of one divine power. This is the approach that was used with Christianity. And if Christianity is removed from the status of a vota zara for non-Jews because the belief in one God, even with different divisions, let's call it that, or manifestations, so it's even more than that. It's a literal incarnation they believe in. If that qualifies as shituf, then I see no reason why Hinduism would also not qualify as shituf, and that would explain the chief rabbinate's opinion there. Now, Goshen might be skeptical about do they really mean it, the chief rabbis, but I prefer to take them at their word. And Daniel Sperber has explained this at great length, that they believe in one God with different manifestations, and therefore this would fall squarely into the category of shituf. And I think if you look at the sources, when you see, use of images. I mean, Jews cannot use images. They cannot use statues. They can't speak about other gods, things like that. But for non-Jews, as far as I can tell, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I can tell, if non-Jews believe in one God, then all these things we're speaking about, statues, images, would be seen as elements of a permitted form of worship. As long as the various gods, if you want to use that term, are seen as manifestations of the one true God. Look, for the authorities who assume that shituf is permissible for non-Jews did not change their opinion because Christians use images. Now you're going to say, well, Hindus, the image, there's actually a manifestation of the God in the image. But if you believe in one God, why is believing in a manifestation? Now, Jews, we do not believe in that because we believe in one God, the whole notion of a division, that won't work. But for the non-Jews, if you believe in shituf, then a manifestation in a spiritual sense of this God, you're taking, as it were, the inside the statue, why would that be forbidden? And by the way, it's not that, as far as the Hindus concerned, the God is everywhere. He's in this desk. He's in the computer. But as a way of giving us a place that we can relate to the God, we declare it here. He assumes residence here, but really he's everywhere. So it doesn't seem to me, at least, that in violation of shituf, as the post scheme have explained shituf with regard to Christianity. So I don't see why the images would be awfully problematic. Now, Rabbi Miller mentioned, you look at Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch speaks about Christians, and then you see that you look at the Christmas season maybe in a little different way because this is how they relate to God. It's incorrect in many certain fundamental ways, but rather than just looking negatively, we see this as an example of striving for some connection to the divine. And Rav Kook speaks very much in this line as well. However, if you, and I published an English translation of a writing of Shamshon Raphael Hirsch where he says important matters regarding this. Well, if this is how you understand Hinduism as shituf, then when you look at the god, the statues, I think you can relate to them differently and not with the same revulsion that I remember. I'm walking down the streets of Benares and I called my wife and said that I literally feel like I'm going to throw up. I mean, I said the tumma. She didn't even know what I meant when I said the tumma. It's like a yeshiva's term. I said the tumma was such that I couldn't stand it. You know, everywhere you walk with all the statues and the people bowing down. But later I started saying maybe that's the wrong way to look at it, the tumma. For a Jew, obviously it is the tumma, the impurity. But if it's shituf and it's permissible, then these are non-Jews reaching out to the divinity in the way they know. It's not at the level that we are, the pure belief in God, but it's something. And also in a book, my book on Rav Kook, he speaks about how even real idolatry sometimes is a help for people as they want to progress to something beyond. So I think I've just, again, as also I said before, for Rabbi Miller, this is really not just on one foot, but on one toenail. And there are people out there who who know Hinduism well. I don't pretend at all to know. What I do know is shituf and the whole story of Christianity. And when I started becoming interested in Hinduism, and I'm really only at the beginning stages of this, and then when I went to India, then I started saying, and it seems to me that, and this is before the chief rabbi, I knew anything about the chief rabbinate statement, that Shituf, the whole category of Shituf, and what for hundreds of years rabbis have dealt with Christianity, and now a whole school of thought puts it firmly in the category of Shituf, meaning a permissible religion for the non-Jews, it would seem to me, at least, and I'm happy to see the chief rabbinate agrees as well, and there have been others, Melech Viswanath, if you know him from Teaneck, a convert, so he knows all about the religion. He also has written about this and others, that it does seem that, at least as far as I can see, that Hinduism doesn't present any more challenges than Christianity. In fact, maybe even less in to a certain extent, because if you speak about manifestations of the one God, even in a physical sense, that's not like Christianity that speaks. You know, the Trinity is really three separate beings. That's the great mystery of the Trinity. So look, I've spoken a lot, and we titled it really Thoughts on Judaism and Hinduism, because it really was more of a free flowing, just my thinking, which I'm still trying to work out. So I'm glad that I was able to share it, and that hopefully you found it interesting. And I'm happy to take, we have some time, Rabbi Kelman, to take some questions and comments. I'll go through it quickly. Dwali, you mentioned Torah in motion. Maybe they will in the future go to India. Rabbi Ari Zivotofsky and Ari Greenspan led that trip. Yosef said you saw it in Bali, what I saw in Benares. Janine, what do Jews who have lived in India for generations say about Hindu religion and practice? Many of them now live in Eretz Yisrael. The Baghdadi Jews assumed that this was Avodah Zarah, classic Avodah Zarah. There's no question about that. Did they know anything about Hinduism? I don't know. The B'nai Israel, there was some influence of Hinduism on the B'nai Israel. I know they deny this, and I know they are very offended if you say this, but there was definitely some influence from Hinduism on it. But then again, these were Jews who were not really rabbinic Jews. But the Baghdadi Jews, India was full of Baghdadi Jews from Baghdad. In fact, the Ben Ish Chais, the famous responsum of Rabbi Yosef Chaim, it's actually in his Rav Pe'ali, permitting riding a bicycle on Shabbos, was sent to the Jews in India. Bombay or Calcutta, I forget now which one. And you had big Talmidei Chachamim in India, the Sassoon family and others, and they thought it was a Avodah Zarah. Justin says that in offhand conversations with Indian co-workers over the years, there was a firm contention that all the Hindu gods were manifestations of the Supreme Godhead. And that is exactly my experience without exception. All the Hindus I've been in touch with in the West, and I made a point of it. And yet, when I was in India, look, if I had spoken to others, I would have got the same approach. But I can tell you that the people, the three or four tour guides who I hired, who were college graduates, I believe every one of them, when I asked the question, they gave the much more simple explanation, maybe that of not one supreme god, but of different gods. Maybe they misunderstood my question. Maybe they understood gods as angels, like, or whatever. And Charles said, Jews have lived in India for thousands of years. The question is, we know they were there in medieval times. In fact, the Rambam's brother was, he died going out to India. And the question is, though, the Indians we have today, the B'nai Israel, how far back do they actually go? Is this medieval? Is this later? You have the B'nai Menashe, B'nai Ephraim there. Are these actual descendants of Jews? Are these just groups that picked up certain Jewish practices? If you're saying that B'nai Menashe, then they go back way, way far in B'nai Ephraim. I don't want to get into that now. And yes, you asked the same question, Yehudi. The post-scheme of India assumed that this was real Avodah Zarah. But on the other hand, the post-scheme of India, there's no evidence that they actually discussed this matter. And the Christians also said it's idolatry. Gandhi, in his autobiography, mentions he had very negative feelings about Christianity. later on, he finally read the Bible and the New Testament, and he changed his mind. He said, in fact, if all the Christians were like Jesus, I'd have no hesitation calling myself a Christian. But he writes in his autobiography that people would, I believe it's in the autobiography, The Story of My Experiments with Truth, I think that's the title of it, that there would be people who would stand outside his school when he was a child going to school, Christians, missionaries, and they're calling Hinduism idolatry or paganism, things like that. So the colonialists who were there, the English and the Protestants and Catholics, because there were some Catholics there too in Goa, they all assumed that it was paganism. And the real problem was when the Muslims came, because in Islam, paganism is forbidden. The only people who are allowed to live in the Islamic Empire are people, what they call people of the book. So Jews and Christians were regarded as people of the book. So we were allowed to live. Pagans were all executed, or they were given a choice, conversion or death. So then the Muslims go into India. So you'd think that they would say, well, all these Indians are pagans because they're worshiping idolatry. But that would have been very hard to do because there were a lot of Indians. And how are they supposed to destroy all these Indians? So the position was that Hindus were also put into the people of the book because they have their text, the Vedas. So, let me just write the question, please.
What's the exact definition of Shituf? Explain Shituf.
Shituf is literally means association, associate. So you believe in the one God, but you associate other beings with it. So the idea would be that you believe in God, the one God, supreme God, Hashem, but you associate Jesus. You also claim that Jesus also shares in the divinity. So that would not be enough to deny you being a monotheist, because as long as you believe in one God, which another being shares in the divinity, since you believe in one divinity, but divided, but you believe in one, and Christians believe in one God. Yes, they say there's three parts, but they also believe in one. That's the great mystery. So therefore, the rabbi said that Christianity is Shituf. They believe in one God, but they divide this one God into different parts, but it's still one God. As opposed to if they believed, let's say, in three gods, some Zoroastrianism, at least old Zoroastrianism. You have the good God and the God of light, God of darkness. If you have three gods, I'm not sure about Mormonism, by the way. Mormonism might actually not be Shituf. Take a look at some of the things they believe. But if you believe that Jesus is one God and, the Father is another God and they're totally separate, it wouldn't fall back in Shituf, I think. Now, Amalia says you just got back from 2 weeks in India. You say that prayers you can accept as an idolatry, but you offer sacrifices to various altars of various gods. They try to act morally. So here's my question for you. Again, you say gods. If they believe in one God with different non-Jews are allowed to offer sacrifices. We can't offer a sacrifice without a base of Middash. Non-Jews are allowed to offer sacrifices already. So what's the problem with a non-Jew offering a sacrifice? Is the problem that they're offering it to a god? Let's say they were offering it to the one god. And didn't we just say that the god is just a manifestation of the one god? So how is that idolatry? How is that Avodah Zarah? It looks like Avodah Zarah. Believe me, I saw it myself. It certainly looks like what we've been accustomed to think. But if you're trying to understand how the chief rabbinate could say it's not, I think it's the avenue of Shituf, the idea that non-Jews, they can do sacrifices, they can do these things, and